This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
This is the pod you've always wanted to hear. We are two guys that sometimes drink beer, and we say things that your mom told you to fear. It's the bad, 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 bad Christian. Today's show is sponsored by Marriage Supply.
Marriage Supply. If
you are married, what's one of the things you like doing? How about tickling
dinner.
Each other's fancy?
Yeah,
how about getting
too.
Intimate and sensual? Well, that's where Marriage Supply comes in. It's for you folks out there that want to spice your marriage up. And after 2020, damn, don't you want a little bit more spice and being around each other for days on end? It never ends, so you might as well at least get some sex, right, Matt?
Yeah, I mean, but spending more time out of the house and then come back for the sex.
Right.
Like when you're stuck in
exactly.
a pandemic, as far as I understand it, nobody had sex during the pandemic.
I don't think they did.
It was just
I'm pretty
shitty.
Sure they didn't. And that's where Marriage Supply comes in. We're ready for couples to start having sex again.
Again.
And
exactly.
we have some great adult toys and products just for you. So go to marriagesupply.com. What else is this show sponsored by, Matt?
Is sponsored by Emory, the band.
Oh, really?
It's sponsored by Emory Land, where you can get on demand our specials, The Week's End and I'm Only a Man. They're really amazing. But beyond specials, you can get them on Blu-ray. And if you're an Emory Land member, you get 25% off of those puppies right there. And you can watch them right now on demand in our content library in Emory Land. But the Blu-rays are awesome. It's a higher quality than MP3 on Spotify. It also has full video of the performance. The performances were live. They're incredible of our albums, I'm Only a Man and The Week's End. We think they're the embodiment of those songs better than when we normally play them live. And really, there's more there than the MP3. There's a real passion and energy to it. The audio's great. The video's great. And so we're excited about that format. We're making a new record in that format very soon. So, Toby, I know you're going on vacation today. Anyway, for that, you go to Blu-ray.com. No, you go to EmoryMusic.com and find the shop. Or just go to Blu-ray.com. You'll find it. Don't worry.
You wouldn't believe it. It was on GoGo. It was on GoDaddy. Blu-ray.com was just free. So we got it for $1.99.
It's funny just talking about Blu-rays because it's an old technology or a new one. It's weird because it's obviously sounds kind of old in a way. But
yeah.
at the same time, vinyls are old. And Blu-ray
right.
Has this really high quality, and people put it on their TV. I feel good that people experience our art in a way that is new. And that way is
yeah.
cast to the TV or on
yeah.
a DVD primary, not, you know, like that's a new whole field for us to create art for, and I'm quite interested about that.
I meant to look it up. I had wondered if people, like, because of the pandemic, had, like, cut some costs and were like, let's cut Netflix, let's cut Disney Plus and all that stuff, and we got a shitload of shelves over here full of DVDs. Let's watch those. I was wondering if, like, DVD
start mailing
watching.
Them out, like
just
Netflix.
Because, yeah, your entertainment did really, it's centered around the TV for a while, but now, I mean, because of the pandemic changed so much, I can't believe it. And you know what's been really cool, honestly? I think it's in our minds that you keep hearing about the death toll and it was scary and there's some people that are clinging on to that and it's really, and that is horrific. I mean, how many people have died now? Over 500,000, right? In just America.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that is just horrific. That is terrible. I do not want to diminish that at all. Now, what I will say is so many people said it was a good year. Like they got, they slowed down. They took a break. Yeah. They hung out with their family more. They realized some stuff about themselves and they don't, and they, you know, people are somehow making it. It might get worse now that everything's opening back up. Like our finances and our life might all get worse, but that year it really has changed people to go, well, what is this? And what do I need to do? And how am I going to do it? So that's why I was thinking maybe I actually enjoyed going to the movies with Devin. We saw that movie Wrath of Man with Jason Statham. It was good. It's a Guy Ritchie film. And I was like, oh, it's fun to be back at the movie theater. But there's only like 10 people in the whole theater. Nobody sat near us. And I was like, this is really cool. Yeah. Because I got to enjoy the screen and everything. But watching movies at home, like watching Mayor of Easttown and stuff, I'm just really enjoying it. And yeah. It's on my conditions. And the technology is only going to get more and more, right? I mean, it's only going to become more immersive in your home.
Well, yeah, and that's what we're going to be talking about here in a few minutes when Peter joins us because, you know, I ran across this article that says that really, really well about the digital sensorium, and it's basically this premise that the social media and the all the technologies that we have, like you're talking about, are moving from theater to personal, and they're getting closer and closer to you. We all understand that trend has increased a lot from the pandemic, right. And is going to increase with your AirPods and then whatever, you know, whatever it is, our Twitter, our everything that we do, let's see if I can say this right. The vibe of it was, it's the public square. Twitter's the public square, but it's not the public square. It's more, they think of it more as they are interfaces of more sensory organs of yours. So it's more like Twitter is an extension of you. Like you have a vibe of Twitter, and you present yourself away on Twitter, or if you have you have a digital leash. If people are tracking you on GPS, it feels like a leash. It's right. And you feel that sense, like you feel tracked. That's a sense you have. So like our technologies become, you know, exoskeletons or external memory of ours, or, we're becoming cybernetic in a way that the technologies are actually extending our sense making ability. So our five senses are greatly extended by digital technologies, which is a different model than looking at it as the public square as it becomes closer and closer to you. They're extensions of you. And that's a different paradigm.
You said something the other day that has kind of struck with me. It was in an email, but you were talking to Katie about, you know, she's been doing a really great job. And you said something to the effect of she was frustrated because some of the technology with our app and with Emeryland isn't quite there yet. And we're trying to do some work around and figure that out. And he said, that'll probably be just common that you'll have the vision, but the technology won't quite be there yet. And I was thinking, oh man, we really live in a time now where it used to be, you know, movies or Star Trek or something would forecast what it could be like, but it was a little goofy or whatever. But now you personally, it's not just in the movies. It's not just science fiction anymore. You personally can come up with ideas and creations in your mind, and the technology is going to have to catch up to you, and you, the individual, will be able to think that big.
Yeah, yeah. I think of it as people all use technology different. Like they just use it differently. Like you can be super tuned into Twitter or not, and that's different. That's like you have good vision or you have good hearing. Like it's part of how you process the world. That's through these sense organs or interfaces that are digital technologies. So that's, you know, that's all pretty freaky.
I was watching, I just had to, it was on the, I saw it, I was scrolling through this menu of movies and TV shows. And I was like, first of all, just how hilarious it is. I now spend a really good amount of time scrolling through entertainment and deciding in an instant good or bad, yes or no to watch, right? Mm-hmm. And it's funny, because I mean, it's probably just the same as music. I try to listen to new music and I enjoy it, but I always go back to my classics and my favorites. You know what I mean? Stuff that I was listening to back in the 90s or the 80s or something like that. And I stopped on this movie and I was like, I gotta watch it. It was Demolition Man.
Nice.
Sylvester Stallone and Wesley Snipes. And it's so funny because the technology, just like I was saying earlier, the technology hadn't caught up yet, but they had this vision of what it would be. And so like there's that, the sex scene in the movie is them just sitting across from each other in the computer system, AI, augmented reality thing, connects them to a sexual experience, right?
Yeah. Yep.
And I was thinking, whoa, that's it, when I watched that, I was like, I don't ever be that, man. You got to go straight P to V. You know what I mean? You got to do that. You'll never get tired of that. And now I go, oh, yeah, you will. That'll seem gross in the future. Like,
yeah.
A sexual contact.
Yeah, that's like toxic masculinity, and barbaric stuff. You just want to bone it. Like, no, we're not doing that.
And the technology is trying to catch up. Like, forever, like, like Mare Supply, there's vibrators now that can be controlled by your phone. And so, you could be in California, your wife could be in New York, and you go, oh, let's have a little sexy time while you're at the hotel. And then you get to control the speed and the vibrations of the vibrator.
Yes.
And like, you are manipulating the vibrator to give her pleasure, but it's you doing it. Mm-hmm. So she doesn't know what to expect or whatever. And I was like, man, that's so crazy. Going back to Demolition Man, the same thing. It's going to get more and more. I mean, like with heptic suits and then just even more. At some point, you'll hook up with somebody and you won't leave the house, and it won't be penetration or another human penetrating you or being penetrated or whatever that might be. You know what I mean? It'll be, oh, I'm going to enjoy this, and that person's not even here. And eventually it won't even be a person, right? It'll just be some AI or robot or Android or something like that. We've been saying that for years. It's coming.
Oh, it's coming fast. But I think a way to think of that is the AirPods go in your ear. They're like in-ear monitors. So in-ear monitors were before AirPods, if you recall, right?
Yes.
Okay. So I've been using in-ear monitors for more than 10 years, probably 10 years before AirPods came out. So, okay, fine. Now, one of the things about in-ear monitors is that drummers will get in-ear monitors, and then they'll get what they call the butt thumper. Do you know what the butt thumper is?
Yeah.
The butt thumper is a haptic device that sits on the drum throne and puts sub bass and makes your seat vibrate.
Yeah.
So it's because the headphones don't make as much low end as the real subs do.
Right.
So drummers sit there on a thing that makes their butt vibrate with haptic feedback caused by low frequencies of audio that their drums and the bass guitar make.
Right.
Now, that is a clunky device. It has a big speaker transducer that sticks to the bottom of the drum throne.
Right.
So then they came out with AirPods. And so as soon as they came out with AirPods, it's obvious to me that the slimmer version of that butt thumper is simply a vibrating butt plug.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
It's just now a little thing. It's the pinky size thing.
Put it up there.
The drummers put up their butt, and it gives them the sub. It gives them the, you don't have to have that big clunky thing with the wire and all. Of course, it'd be a Bluetooth thing. So, you've got Bluetooth, you got AirPods, you've already got the butt thumper stuff. Musicians pioneer, rock drummers been all about butt stimulation for a long time, it turns out. So they've pioneered that technology, and then your wife is wearing it, and you can start buzzing her up, during one of her meetings to let you know you love her.
So now you're telling me Mary Supplies a music store, too.
Exactly.
An online music store. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, all that stuff is good. I've been seeing the wristbands that are like a metronome, and you just feel it. And I started thinking, we've relied for so long on vision and hearing as just the two epic senses, and then taste, you know what I mean? I was thinking that clip, that feeling is better. Like, it's always hard for me sometimes to hear the metronome, especially when music starts playing loud or anything like that, and you got to put in your headphones, and it's clunky. It's interfering with the things that you want to hear, like the quality of your voice or the guitar part that you're hearing in your in-ear monitors. And I was like, you're going to feel more in
the
future.
You can feel the click.
And that sense is going to become even more important than we've ever known before. Feeling, oftentimes, I mean, we know our feeling is most often associated with pain or not pain. Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's basically as far as we go with it. And now we might be able to use our skin and our body and our nerves to actually even experience more of the world than we have. That sense
more
is,
of
is
the world. That's
bigger.
Right. Yes. You're expanding the five senses. That's what instead of saying, we're building buildings and stores in cyberspace.
Right.
Well, that's the basic. That's the basic things like, we'll build Walmarts online and call that a store, and it'll be Amazon. That's fine. But really what we're doing when we design interfaces is adding to our senses of the world.
Yeah.
So that's just, I think that's just a whole paradigm shift. So the thing that's really freaky about it is that there's so much, it's so unexplored though. And what are we going to do and who's going to do what? And then your senses that you develop are going to diverge from other people. So it'll be harder and harder to communicate with people because you'll develop new sets of skills for interfacing with the world, and other people will develop other sets. But it used to be we all had the normal five senses, and we could relate about stuff. But you could develop this whole inner life and sensory experience for yourself to take in a new world that's digital, and that's not so easy to share with others.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right. Well, so like for people, I've been wondering, like, because we've been talking about VR, like, I mean, creating a like with our specials, like with doing I'm Only a Man and The Week's End, and now we're doing our new record and The Question, it'll be coming out later this year. We're creating an experience for you to try and affect all your senses outside of just going to a club and seeing that band perform. You know,
it's, yeah, it's more to, layers to create.
We're trying to tap into more of that. But I'm wondering, like, when you talk about VR, does the brain work like if there's a blind person, will virtual reality work for them? Because it'll tap into parts of their mind that are visual, but it's not just the eyeball seeing it or
now
hearing.
Now we're talking. Yeah,
I mean, is that going to come? Like, will the blind see? Because they're in a digital world, and they'll actually see just the same as you, but here,
I don't think the same, but they might see differently than you.
Yeah.
That's
maybe, or something.
Different.
Yeah.
Different. So, I don't know. Let's ask Peter, because Peter is now in the waiting room. Peter Berkman he's a musician. He is a thinker. He works for the Center for the Study of Digital Life, and he is here to talk about an article that was written by a friend of his, actually.
Yeah. Aaron Lewis of Stained.
Aaron Lewis, not of Stained, but who wrote the article, The Digital Sensorium, which I think is worth a read, and we'll discuss it here, and we'll link it in the show notes.
We were just talking about the movie Demolition Man and how that's how we'll have sex in the future, for sure.
Oh, yeah, don't forget the shells, man.
Right.
This guy doesn't even know the shells.
And, the shell, that's what's so funny. We've been talking about this for a bit, but just the idea that that movie – and so many movies forecast really cool things, but they can't, the technology isn't there. So like Wesley Snipes is a heightened human with all the stuff, but he's still just using a keyboard. You know, like he's just using this keyboard to type really fast. You're like, back then you're like, whoa, this is amazing. Look how fast he can type. He is a superhuman, but you know, it's just, they couldn't come up with something better than a keyboard in the future, obviously.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, Peter,
no text-to-speech, no brain interface situation.
Right.
Well, Peter, thank you for joining us.
The 90s were full of beautiful things like that.
it is. Peter, I want to cover a bunch of territory here, so I'm going to just give us a quick overview of the things that I'm interested in here, and we'll see how much we can get to in the time that we got. But the Center for the Study of Digital Life is quite an undertaking and a big deal. It's not something I just discovered it, you know, recently, and so I just kind of want to get an onboarding of what that is and the philosophy and mission of it and how you got involved with it. I think it's quite interesting to talk about your band and music. I don't know if you know it or not, but Toby and I are musicians in a band that's really not that far off from yours. Your band is am I saying it right if I say Onomanaguchi?
You actually, yeah. Okay. First try. Got it.
Good. Yep. I want to talk about that because I think that your band and our band are both very much inspired by Pinkerton.
You're talking the Weezer album.
Yeah, that's our territory, you know. We've been doing it, we've been doing it for 20 years, so touring and playing, you know, post-hardcore version of Weezer is basically what we probably are.
I think we're pretty super close there.
Pretty aligned because it's just interesting that those things overlap and that you are interested in and doing work and thinking really far about society and culture and the future and its technological interfaces. And I see our project overall as to just follow the music trail all the way through that. And, you know, I can't wait to be creating in VR, art, this musical art that taps the same emotions that I care about now in VR and beyond, you know. So that's kind of the path, I think, that links all this together. But the reason that we got connected in the first place was that article on the digital sensorium. That kind of really explains that. And Toby and I have been talking about that a little bit already. I'm going to link that in the show notes. So trying to tie all those three together is great. So if you don't mind, let's start with talking about the Center for the Study of Digital Life and what that is and how you got connected to it.
Yeah, you got it. So the Center for the Study of Digital Life was started by a guy named Mark Stallman, who is if you ever meet the guy, if you ever speak with him, I think maybe you should, if you're interested. He's a very big, I guess to call him a personality would be weird, but he has this particular history. You know, he in the 90s worked as a sort of Wall Street analyst guy, brought AOL public, and then retired shortly after, or I guess somewhere in the mid-90s or the late 90s, and slowly started accumulating a library of basically everything having to do with what we're talking about here, the intersection between technology, society, importantly, psychology, with a particular focus on a couple important figures, one being Marshall McLuhan, who was, you know, this big media figure in the 20th century, came up, you know, this phrase, the medium is the message. Mm-hmm. And another guy that sort of figures very, very much into the ground of what Mark does is was a friend of his father's, the mathematician Norbert Wiener, who came up with the term cybernetics back in the 40s with Mark's dad. And so basically the whole field of like systems theory, blah, 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 sort of comes from that world. But the Center for the Study of Digital Life was a way for Mark to find, I guess, like outlying thinkers who have recognized that the world that we live in has already been profoundly reshaped by digital technology. And, you know, one time I told Mark, sort of, the most important insight that you've had throughout all of this is that digital is not electric, that there's something brand new going on here, that there's a sort of state change, not only in the technology itself and how it works, but how, in turn, it being different shapes our own psychology differently. Not only people, you know, that use the stuff, but much, much more dramatically, children who sort of come of age under those circumstances. Mm-hmm. You know, so I was born in 1988, and I remember a world where my family didn't have a computer in the house. And then sort of the day we first got our PC, like, I was about age 7 when Windows 95 came out. Some people call that the eternal September, where suddenly all the kids flooded onto Usenet and yeah, all these other forums that people had assumed were for adults. And so, you know, me personally, I sort of grew up into this transition from a world super, super dominated by television into one where stuff like computers, the internet, just slowly started taking over that stuff. And, you know, watching younger people, yeah, I was born like with, I suppose, the internet, and there were children born later sort of in the internet. And yeah, you know, it's a different vibe for sure. But the Center for the Study of Digital Life and my intersection with it, that came about when I started studying Marshall McLuhan. So, I had first heard about McLuhan in college at NYU, where I studied music technology. I dropped out, by the way, mm-hmm. My second semester senior year. So my parents were thrilled, obviously. But no, I dropped out to work on video game music and, you know, to continue work with my band, Anna Monoguchi. And so my parents actually, they're all right with it, but McLuhan was one of these figures that really stuck out to me as one of the few like philosophical people that, you know, sort of made any impact on me besides being bored to death. So in my studies, I actually sought out this famous guy, Marshall McLuhan. It turned out he had written his own doctoral dissertation back in the 1940s when he was, you know, 27 or so. So that would have been about like my age when I first discovered the book that that he wrote. And it was on the sort of history of Western or alphabetic education, this curriculum called the Trivium, Grammar, Logic, Rhetoric. And so anyway, it was in my reading of that dissertation that I started thinking this McLuhan guy, there was a lot more depth into what he was saying. I started getting on my computer, taking my keyboard, searching, you know, with particular terms. I'm pretty good at searching on Google, I do have to say. So I never search anything I'm looking for without quotes separating everything, you know. So I'll search, you know, Marshall McLuhan, and then I was actually looking for, you know, maybe you guys know G.K. Chesterton.
Yep.
Here on the Bad Christian Podcast.
You got it.
Chesterton figured greatly into McLuhan's own conversion. So I was looking on the internet to see if there is anybody who had also taken an account of Belloc with McLuhan, because Chesterton and Belloc sort of synonymous. And, you know, I was just idly Googling, like, you know, has anyone said anything about Marshall McLuhan and Hilaire Belloc? So that took me to a blog post where I saw that is Belloc being the guy who brought Chesterton into the church, for instance. So I found this blog post that was about McLuhan and Chesterton. I hit Control F and I was like, there's no Belloc here. Like, what? How did this come up? And then I hit like load all comments. Then there was Mark Stallman in the comments section saying, you know, hello, this is interesting, but I have all these unpublished works from Marshall McLuhan where he's talking about this, that, and the other thing. I emailed with his son, Eric. He read everything that Hilaire Belloc and Chesterton ever wrote. And if anyone would like these unpublished essays, please seek me out. Mark Stallman, New York City. So I was like, okay. And then I found this Center for the Study of Digital Life website. And I was like, all right, looked at the people on there and saw Eric McLuhan listed, who was Marshall's son. But I also saw this guy, Doug Rushkoff, who's a media theorist who I'd actually met up with earlier that year because I liked his work. So I was like, who is this guy? And then I looked for an email for him. And the one that turned up was newmedia@AOL.com. So I was like, okay, I'm going to send an email there and see what happens. And it fired back. So, yeah, that was, Mark. We wound up, meeting for about like, I want to say like 6 to 8 hours in New York City at Bryant Park, where I just had my copy of McLuhan's dissertation. Basically every page was annotated. It's a big history. So he mentions a lot of people, in this dissertation. So I drew little pictures of them, you know, in the margins just to like, it was a massive undertaking, but Mark looked at that and was like, you know, very few people have actually read that. And he was talking about it as if he had read it. And so I was like, okay, interesting. And he goes, you know, he didn't write that, right? I was like, what? What are you talking about? So he's like, that's a Cambridge dissertation, but it was actually written at St. Louis University because it was during the Second World War. And he wrote it with his friend, blah, 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 like, he just knew a lot about what was going on. And at first I was like, is this a crazy guy? But then I went home and I went to, you know, the St. Louis University archive or whatever, and looked up what he was saying. And it was actually bang on. Like, he did write it in St. Louis with this guy that he was talking about. And they had the class notes from that guy's lectures in 1941 or two or whatever. And sure enough, it's the same sort of structure. Mm-hmm. So that was a meandering long version to say that the Center for the Study of Digital Life, I'll just rephrase how I introduced it, was made to study how digital technologies have particular effects on human psychology and the way that we shape our societies. And those effects are distinct from those that preceded it. You know, really a process that started with the telegraph, where electricity as a mode of communication sort of pushed out the print world, mm-hmm. which previously had pushed out the scribal, handwritten world. So, you know, electronic communications include things like the radio, things like television, but also, yeah, the Morse code that came before that. But, you know, there are very, very few people who make that distinction to study digital technology per se, and also to then think through the implications of what that means for our lives.
Yeah.
And to say, we're not doing that anymore. So this is how this stuff works. This is what we understand about it. This is what we tend to ignore about it. And then sort of going, therefore, you know, while trying to absorb as much stuff that people tend to not pay attention to. Mm-hmm. Sort of stuff that people tend to either make a value judgment about, oh, this is good or this is bad. Our style is to just kind of be open-minded, I suppose, and take things in and probe and experiment and see what happens. So I know that you guys found me through Aaron Lewis, who is a friend who wrote the Digital Sensorium article. So we actually got connected through that guy, Doug Rushkoff, I was talking about, who I had first met in 2016. So I'll briefly mention that connection because I think it's kind of interesting. So Doug Rushkoff is a friend of Mark Stallman's. They actually have a podcast together they recorded on Doug's podcast, Team Human. That was a few years back, which does a much better explanation of what the Center for the Study of Digital Life is up to, better than I did. But so Doug is an author, a sort of media person, good at appearing publicly in front of a microphone. But he made these documentaries that super affected me when I was maybe like 12 or in, you know, around middle school. They showed us a documentary in our art class called The Merchants of Cool, which was all about how kind of the sausage is made at Viacom or like MTV or Nickelodeon or Comedy Central. This sort of like, how did cool in the form that it was understood in the late 90s get invented as like a pseudo identity to become and then sell back to kids, you know? Mm-hmm. And like, how is that process of making a way of life, like making culture by hunting out culture done? Like, so it followed people like cool hunters, but then it also followed like people who go out to small shows and interview kids and stuff. This is back in like 2000 or 99. And then it would study like focus group people and then focus, like study producers who decide what, you know, what's going to go on, networks and stuff. And then what ads they're going to sell against it. And how those ads will be made, blah, blah, blah. So I saw that when I was about 12, and fast forward about 15 years later, I was about to go on tour with, my band, in support opening for a hologram called a Vocaloid software called Hatsune Miku. I don't know if you're familiar with Miku, but no. For anyone who can't see, Hatsune Miku is a blue-haired, I guess, teenage anime sort of girl who is really this software, like vocal software, you know? So a sort of like elaborate text-to-speech singer that anyone can type in words and anyone can program. And so we were about to go on tour with Miku. And I was like, Doug, I would love to talk to you about a lot of things. So Aaron, again, around this time, Aaron had been talking with Doug about a bunch of things. So Doug also, he's written a bunch of books. One's called Program or Be Programmed. Doug basically is just was sort of trying to champion trying to like figure out how these things work, you know. And so, yeah, I will, I've been talking too much, but I will digress from this discussion that the projects that I am currently working on for the Center of the Study of Digital Life, number one is, we are trying to, figure out how, education can better work in this, new mode. And so,
is that because of 2020, you mean? Like, but you, and when you say new mode, you mean digitally, like Zoom and stuff?
Well, yeah, Zoom will probably factor in, but just a sort of total thing.
The whole paradigm shift of the new way of looking. You know, that's what I'm hearing in your backstory there. This very fascinating, if I can summarize it, it almost seems like, from your point of view, and this is what I like about it, it's almost mystical, because it almost feels like you have a calling and it was this mysterious thing and you found the guy and, you know, you had all this self-directed energy toward the field itself and you found this guy from the 40s who has a great conceptual awareness of the paradigm shift that we're entering in 2020 really. It's kind of really, things have tipped and sped up, and there's this guy who was way ahead of his time, McLuhan, that you kind of had found and channeled and found in the hidden. You know, that's the way I hear that story, and it reminds me of a calling, is really what it, like you were, couldn't help but follow that line.
That's the word, yeah. Like for me, I mean, I've never really spoken publicly about my conversion. Well, I call it a maybe like reversion, but so I was born, raised Catholic, but my parents, you know, the story is the same for a lot of people in my situation. I was born in 88. My parents were born in like 50, 52. And that is to say, was raised in like a pretty like secular situation, you know. My parents, my mom taught CCD, which is like sort of Sunday school situation, but you know, so like we had stories, but there was no like organized religion. You know, it was sort of like, yeah, this is what we have. And then by the time you're an adult, you can figure it out for yourself. And, you know, my family, we all stopped going to church by the time I was like 12 or something. And so, you know, neither of my parents were particularly religious. And by the time I got confirmed, I didn't go into a church again, really, unless someone died or someone was getting married or whatever. So, yeah, sometime around 2016, early 2016, I started getting, you know, transitioning from being totally agnostic about anything, just like pursuing music, pursuing whatever it was I was doing. And that sort of like hit a wall for me, and I needed to zoom out a little bit. And particularly, I learned that I needed to pray. And I hadn't done that for a long, long time. And so somewhere in early 2016, prayer led me to this sort of calling. Yeah. And that's really how it happened. And so I wound up back, you know, my parents were like, what happened to you? Like, why are you so religious now? Like, not on like an "are you okay" sort of way, but like, they were just like kind of surprised. And yeah, soon, like my parents' friends who were still religious, were, like they wanted to ask me like, why, like everyone was just deeply confused. So yeah, I think calling is the right word, and it still motivates, you know, everything that, that we do, or at least that I do, you know, in this field. So
I think that helps too, because it makes it more authentic that you found it on your own, or there was a desire, or like you said, you learned you needed to pray. Like I grew up evangelical in the South, and I didn't learn I needed to pray. I just was told I had to do it or else I was evil, you know?
Yeah,
and so,
exactly.
But now that I've gotten away from it, like, you know, I've deconstructed a bunch and gotten, I don't attend church at all anymore. I found myself naturally going, oh, I'm missing something. What is, oh yeah, mate, I am thankful. Like I was a couple of podcasts ago or whatever, I said, I'm realizing that I am thankful when I sit down with my family and eat dinner. And so it's not just you pray because you're supposed to. Like I was like, oh, I'm actually really thankful in this moment. God, thanks. You know, like, yeah. and it felt real and authentic in a way that it didn't before. But it is funny that it's a calling, and you're seeing it more. Like, I'm wondering if everything, it maybe even what we're talking about here is some mix of spiritual and digital, and if they're not one and the same in a sense.
There's something like really funny going on there, and I have just a sense of it, and it's not something I can articulate at this time. But I too feel drawn to the area. I thought that when I kind of deconstructed Christianity, that I would become more mechanical, but now the mystical things and it's really, just to get back to what we're talking about, the education or the paradigm shift. There's some people who could see it long in advance, and some people can see in advance now of what it's going to be like when we have extended humanity into absolutely bizarre ways that will seem super bizarre. And we're in the middle of that right now. And so it's as if the new paradigm is one that some people can visualize and some people can't, and some people resist. And it has the parallel to Christianity. It's like, well, you know, the kingdom, like, you know, in the God's kingdom, it's an overlay to this reality. If you're a Christian, you talk, well, kingdom values or kingdom this or what. That's a different paradigm, a way of looking at the world. And I think the digital realm that we're entering into, that you can rebuild everything in it, but it's in new ways. It's not just copying retail for the internet. It's like
although McLuhan liked to say, we always use the new thing for the old job.
Yeah.
You know? We never like to look at something for what it is and what it can do. Where I was like, oh, that'll work for what I used to do. And then we spend 90% of the energy doing that. Meanwhile, in the background, you know, 10% of the energy is being spent by people who don't have those sort of preconceived things on top of it, and wind up being like, well, it could also be used for that, or it could be used for that. And that sort of winds up taking over. But yeah, there's in terms of that whole like praying thing, it's like, I like thinking of it as in terms of like breathing, you know, praying and acting. So, you know, breathing in and out, it's as if to say like, you know, oh, you know, I only breathe in. You know, it's like, okay, right. Well then you're going to suffocate just as much as if you only breathed out. So it's this like push-pull situation that always needs to be, you know, it's like I was holding my breath for 10 years, basically.
Right.
Like that first time.
I have a similar experience in the way I would say it's super bizarre, but, you know, a lot of the focus on the stuff and the digital sensorium and your article about piece about the McLuhans and stuff like that, it really starts to highlight the inner self, basically. And so the way I look at my story is, until recently, I didn't know about that. I've been an external person operating in a single mode, not reflective or anything. I've just been living, doing in a very, you know, concrete driven external mode. And now I understand that there is an inner life, and I have one. Right. I know, and I think everybody else already knew about that they had an inner life, but I wasn't. It was like holding my breath for a really long time is what it feels like. So now it's like, oh, there are other modes, there are other mental states than the one I've always been directly in. Like, I've had a very stable mood, very intense, very focused, no ups and downs, just living. And now I understand that there's these other states of mind or zones or places you can be. And as the digital technology changes and stuff, that's very, very directly impacting my inner landscape and what it is, basically. So it's like
a
whole new
world. Talking about, I was going to say too, when we're talking about the digital sensorium, because I don't totally get all of this, but we're just throwing that term around kind of casually. I don't know if I had never heard of it before the article.
Yeah, that term comes from an article written by Aaron Z. Lewis.
Yeah. Not of Stained. Not the band Stained, right?
Exactly.
But
we're
talking about our senses in the digital world, right?
Yeah, you explain that, Peter? Yeah. What does it mean to that paradigm shift there? Or we could talk about some of the examples in that article about the Twitter exoskeleton.
This I think, is a perfect sort of pivot to the core points that we've sort of stumbled on in this research. So that title inside the digital sensorium is a updated version of an old McLuhan title, which was Inside the Five Sense Sensorium, right? So McLuhan had this thought that, okay, well, if we're on the radio, in terms of our outer senses, our ears are doing a ton of work and we're not paying attention to what our vision's doing, you know, just as much. Just as when we're reading silently, we're filling in that gap sort of auditorially in a way by, you know, we're not hearing it, but we're hearing it. So
internally hearing it when you read.
Yeah. Right. And so in my article on the McLuhans and the inner senses, I sort of point out that Marshall McLuhan was fascinated with this, and in fact, all of his work centers around this kind of forgotten doctrine, really, in medieval psychology and even classical psychology before it. You know, I was taught when I was in kindergarten, maybe you guys do, that we have five senses, right? You know, we have vision, we have sound, touch, taste, and smell, the other one. So, but roughly since, you know, 300 BC up through really, I think the 1600s, it's not until then that this stuff sort of starts fading, is it was widely believed, and there were different formulations of it, that there were also something called inner senses, or in English, they were sometimes called our wits, inward wits. And you'll find them in Chaucer, you'll find them in Shakespeare, you'll find them in any poetry. And some people said there were four, some said there were five. Marshall sort of discovered this whole thing in the work of St. Thomas Aquinas and was like, whoa, there's this thing that St. Thomas calls the common sense, which he found in Aristotle and onward, the sensus communis, or common sense, which is not what you know, we would know common sense as, which is like, oh yeah, that's what you do, that's common sense. This term in this, it's a scientific term, and it means what happens to each of those particular senses, outer senses, as they become integrated into one impression in the, really in the front of the brain, which is what they all believe this is, the sensus communis. And then those impressions are stored in something called the imaginative power, where they can be rearranged in various ways. So the example given in one of these books is you can imagine the sensible form of a man and then combine that with the sensible form of flight and make a flying man that you've never seen before. And that's sort of the imaginative power. And then there was St. Thomas and McLuhan would have accepted four, but McLuhan never really got to this stuff, which is what my article is about. So the third one, after sensus communis and the imaginative power, is something that was called the cogitative power, which has been translated as thought or thinking things through. This one is considered by St. Thomas and the other medievals to be the sort of highest power that is in the body of human beings. So we're still talking about the brain, but that is the highest sort of knowledge faculty.
To be able to think through things explicitly internally.
Yeah. And so this means like knowing a particular what's called intention, like this tree. Actually, here's the way that St. Thomas puts it. So he says in the Ten Commandments, you have, these are all intellectual, right? So you have, thou shalt honor thy mother, thy father and mother. So he says, through the intellect, you know father, through the intellect, you know mother, but it's through the senses, and particularly the cogitative power, that you know my father, my mother. So you have this form of father, mother, this pattern, but it's recognized in particular in, that is, in material reality by this or that. And the word for that they use is intention. It's very bizarre. So, but just like the sensus communis has this relationship with imagination, where the sensible form is then retained, and then you can do various things with it. The cogitative power has a similar relationship with memory, the memorative power. So what that does is it not only keeps these particulars in time, but it also nests these forms within each other. So, the example that Aristotle, I think, gives is, son of Cleon. So this sort of not just the particular of like my father, but also a sort of causal investigation is brought in through the memorative power. And so just to bring this back to like, what does the digital sensorium mean? The most dramatic sort of way to illustrate that is to say that electronic technology, or rather electric technology, really starting from the telegraph up through television, this is a technology which really, really, really ramped up our ability to imagine, to compose things together that had never been imagined before, from screens to picture things that are not there, you know, on a scale that human beings had literally never done before. Just as dramatically as digital technology amplifies memory. And it's difficult to imagine a more radical shift in a psychological, technological environment. But, it's comparable really to, what's sometimes called the Axial Age, where you had people who lived in an oral society, you know, bound by speech. And then suddenly you have people who not only know how to write, but you have a society shaped by writing and by literacy. Thinking of Christ's incarnation, you know, he called the Logos, the Word. He's walking around, his mother read the Hebrew scriptures, you know, sat in temple and stuff. And he walks around, picks 12, you know, unimpressive, illiterate men, really. But they are sort of moved to preserve his word in one way or another, by the Holy Spirit. And that, Christ never wrote anything down, never told anybody to write anything down, and yet they did. And that process of keeping something worth passing down through writing, and not just through writing, but through speech and rehearsal of that writing, dramatic rehearsal of it, the sort of like the liturgy of that early church is impossible to picture without how writing shaped the memory of those first priests.
It is the technology that makes the difference on the Jesus story, basically.
Yeah, I mean, that technique of preserving the presence of something absent, and not only its presence, but its intention. That, like, because you can call a word into being just by saying it, but to keep it in writing and to know how to interpret it and to know how to pronounce it correctly, this all takes an enormous amount of training. Like, children are not born knowing how to do this, you know? And so this is, to bring this back to the digital situation, it's comparable to sort of learning how to read again, and also recognizing that we leave a trail behind us, you know, as we move through this, like, insane memory scape that we've built without really recognizing that that's what we were doing throughout that process, you know?
Yeah, it goes back to what you said earlier about the message is the medium or whatever. I never really thought about that, but just the idea of Jesus without the technology of the written word doesn't exist to us today. right?
Yeah, because I mean, there's a way in which he chose to present himself and to reveal himself. Yeah. McLuhan liked to say, you know, Christ would have suffered a very different fate under Genghis Khan. You know, it was this encounter between the Jewish people who wrote in scrolls for thousands of years with the Romans, who had adopted alphabetic writing from the Greeks and had laws and modes of, you know, hierarchical organization structured around writing. You know, it's really a kingdom of speech that the Romans built. And Christ revealed God's attitude toward these things. You know, just as they nailed him to a cross and wrote above him in all these different languages. And it's very fascinating to me to think about the incarnation in terms of a sensory event for humanity, and to always go back to who these people were, how God chose to meet them. There's a sort of infinite number of questions that can come from this. There's something beautiful that I found in the beginning of, I think it's the first letter of John. Let me see if I can read this. Yeah. So, yeah, he says, "That which was from the beginning, which we have heard, which we have seen with our eyes, which we have looked at and our hands have touched, this we proclaim concerning the word of life. The life appeared. We have seen it and testified to it, and we proclaim to you the eternal life, which was with the Father and has appeared to us. We proclaim to you what we have seen and heard, so that you may have fellowship with us. And our fellowship is with the Father and with his Son, Jesus Christ. We write this to make our joy complete." And in some manuscripts, it says your. So, to make your joy complete. So, that is a sort of sensory profile. That's a whole story of what I just said there. Of, okay, we've seen it. Now what do we do?
Yeah.
Right.
So we have this, we have, you know, five senses, which is kind of nonsense. I mean, what a dumb idea. The dumbest part of that idea is that the five senses are all that reality is. You know, is it, how funny is it that we know what reality is because we use our five senses to know, but those are just happen to be the five senses that we have and are familiar
with. Well, yeah, we share, you know, and we share those organs with, you know, animals. So my dog has that, or this, the cat in this picture, the one it represents, but the story doesn't end there. You know, you have the impressions of them, you have the intention behind it. And so the way that our material senses, which we share with animals, touch formal existence in terms of divine ideas, the or what Augustine calls the rationes eternum, eternal reason, that is done in the human being by this thing that we've totally forgotten how to talk about, this cogitative power of thinking things through to the point that they're understood. That understanding in this medieval schema is called the intellect. So these intellectual faculties are not shared with my dog, mm-hmm. But they are shared with the angels, who are intellectual beings. And also the demons, who are intellectual beings.
Are we getting closer to being able to communicate them with the digital realm, though? We're moving into a place where our minds are going to have a lot more input from a lot more things. And there are more things that exist than our five senses are able to give us. There are more powers and abilities, sure, that are on the horizon for us.
Yeah, well, there's something that I wanted to get back to with prayer again, which and even Chesterton, Toby mentioned, you know, when I sit at the table, I'm thankful, right? And so how do I deal with that thankfulness? You can look, you don't see God there, you know, on the table. That thankfulness is a kind of pattern recognition of huh, this has happened a lot of times, you know, in tough times and, you know, in good times. Let me think this through. So Chesterton once said something I really like, which is intelligent or gratitude is the highest form of intelligence. That is being able to be thankful for anything, any aspects in a situation, just gives you a deeper access to the nature of the thing. And this is, there are many aspects of this that are only possible for a Christian, I think, which is number one is that sort of depth of gratitude to be sort of eternally seeking through to find the signature of God in things. That's the first one. But the second, which sort of sets it apart from Plato, Aristotle, and everything else, is the ability to just devalue the world altogether, you know, to say, this is not all that it is, you know? So yeah, it's, to bring it back to what you were saying, Matt, that you had just said, it gives us access to more things. In particular, I think what it gives us access to in ways that are super, super different from even like 10, 20 years ago is what was said. The fact that you're able to search things in quotes, and find, like, for instance, in this conversation, if we were just having this on the phone, I might, you know, go out and be like, oh yeah, I have this really interesting conversation with these guys, Matt and Toby, paraphrase what you said. But now, there's going to be a transcript of this that just gets generated by something somewhere,
yeah.
Whether it's uploaded to YouTube or some podcast network, and whether it's robots or humans that are doing that indexing and searching, that indexing and searching will be happening.
So these, what you're saying, you go ahead, Toby.
Sorry, I was going to say, but the sheer amount of it now that, like, when the Bible was written, there wasn't many, you know, wasn't much access to books. Like you said, most people are illiterate. They, you know, you had to have a communicator and all that stuff. I'm assuming that AI and computers and all that now, starting now or already have started, there'll be so much information that they will look at Twitter comments quickly and then judge, oh, this is what humanity is. Even though everybody, the human race goes, no, we're not like that. We're good. We work hard. We care for each other. We do all this stuff. But I mean, if you looked at probably a large section of, you know, Twitter or something like that, our communication, I'm wondering with the amount of time that we spend already, I mean, I can't believe how quickly we moved into spending time in the digital space. I mean, I really have to force myself to get out of the digital space and go shoot hoop with my kids sometimes.
Oh yeah.
You know what I mean? Like that, I want that interaction with them, but also that syrupy sweet something in the digital world, it just calls to me almost like a spirit in a way or something like that. There's a weird place that I can go.
Yeah, you go
on TikTok or something. I go, oh, this gives me humor or something interesting, or maybe, you know what? I can talk to somebody about this, or I can send somebody else this video and they're going to laugh. I know if I send Matt a video, he's going to laugh at it. And I did some connection there that I never had before. It used to be snail mail or something like that or nothing. You know, I grew up, I was born in 76. There was no, we never had a computer in our house. The first time I ever used a computer was at school, and it was like plotting points to make a bunny rabbit. And I was like, right, this is so stupid. This will never catch on. I thought that to myself. And what I immediately did, the funniest part about that is in that class, I immediately realized, oh, wait, I can, there's a file here. What is this file thing? Oh, there's saved other bunny. I didn't even have to make the bunny rabbit. I just took it out, saved it as my name, and then cheated digitally as soon as I could, which is so funny because I would tell you, I'm not a cheater. I'm not, but if you looked at my history, there's some times where, you know, I'm doing this or that. And the way that the world is going to be viewed, that's what's so amazing, I think, about the Bible is that we still hold on to it and there's truths to it and all that. But I wonder what this, at this exact moment, what is really being dug up and revealed about us as humans, right? Like, will people look back on this and go, oh man, spiritually speaking, what a revolution,
comes up in digital circumstances is a word that we're not super familiar with in English. You know, we know who, what, where, why, when, But the word whence, you know, when's the last time you really thought whence?
Yeah.
Which is like, where did that come from? How did that get here? That's the question that memory forces us to confront, you know? And it's something that imagination just leaves off the table. Whence is not an aspect to a world dominated by imagination, but it is the question in circumstances dominated by memory. You know, what structure allowed, how did that happen? You know?
Yeah.
And so bringing it back to that, that sort of like gratitude being the highest form of knowledge, what it does is, you know, basically compels us to, you know, look at the full structures of things. And there's a, McLuhan liked to say, he liked to quote Paul's faith comes through hearing, which is a statement of external sense, I guess. That is, it doesn't come through sight. Right. But I think maybe a bit more to the point is that in terms of like psychological reality, that it comes from memory too. You know, you hear something, you have to be able to recognize what that is in the first place that you're hearing it. Otherwise, it's just, you know, idle sound. But I want to get back to this thought of the inner that Matt was bringing up. So in my studies, there's this... So I mentioned that Mark Stallman is big on Marshall McLuhan and Norbert Wiener, right? Mm-hmm. So for me, it's Marshall McLuhan and this guy, Romano Guardini, who... I'd imagine you guys have never heard of.
No.
Because I haven't met I've met maybe five people who've ever heard the guy's name, but he's very important. But yeah, before I get into that, because it's a big thing that touches on this inner that you're talking about. Yeah, I just wanted to say, you know, so for the center, you know, we're starting a kind of digital university. We're in the beginning stages of that. We also have like a consulting thing called EXO, that stands for exogenous factors. But yeah, the third thing that we're working on right now is a series of conferences. So when I get off this call, I'm going to be working on putting Marshall McLuhan in dialogue with this guy named Father Romano Guardini. So Guardini is... he's a mysterious name to anyone living in America, but he is also the intellectual sort of heritage for both of the last two popes in the Catholic Church. You have Pope Benedict and Pope Francis, Benedict XVI and Francis. People in the U.S. tend to imagine them as somehow being the right wing and left wing of American politics. You know, Oh, you have the conservative and then you have the liberal, but it's not really the case. In fact, they're both united by this guy Guardini, who threw all that stuff away. Guardini, even though he has an Italian name, was actually a German, and he lived through both world wars. A young Pope Benedict went to some of his classes after the Second World War. So Pope Francis in the 80s, when he was Cardinal, or I think just Father Bergoglio, he was going to write his dissertation about Guardini, flew to Germany to do it, and then abandoned it because he had a bunch of work to do. So you'd think for someone so important, someone would have said something about this stuff in English, but nobody has. So I've gone and looked at the text that Francis was studying in the 80s in Germany, which is this thing written in 1925. An earlier version of it was written in 1914 by Guardini. But it is very, very fascinating and touches on exactly what you're talking about, Matt, of this, you know, living externally, but then suddenly recognizing that you have this inward thing and then realizing that they're in tension with each other and that, you know, they sort of demand each other. So I started translating this with Google Translate. You know, I don't know German. I don't know how to speak it at all. But with the internet, I do know German people, I can like get in touch with them. So I now have a full shitty translation next to the full German transcription that I typed out, paragraph by paragraph, numbered. And I've got some people proofreading it, and it's a lot of fun.
That's neat.
To know that this can just happen. So, but the most dramatic thing too, so we talked about a world of imagination moving to a world of memory. If the electric world and its imagination is tied to how do we manage pretty much being tripping all the time, you know, without taking drugs, you know, right. We're basically just hallucinating our way through life and living by our ability to hallucinate well.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. I like that.
In this circumstance, it becomes, how do we live where we're basically in a world of robots? Where if we're not careful, we become robots. Mm-hmm. And if we, we're already surrounded by things that actually are robots. We carry them in our pockets. We're using them right now. There are as many sensors and microphones and cameras probably as eyes and ears out there. So it becomes very important to distinguish what these things are as we move into a world of, you know, where human rights leads into a conversation about robot rights. Mm-hmm. And what are these things made of? And so Guardini's work here that Francis was studying in the 80s, I'll just read the opening paragraph to it because this is my translation. It's not great. I'm sure some German Guardini scholar will say, not quite, but I think it's all right. So it opens with the question, and it says, if we look at ourselves, inside ourselves, we find bodily form, limbs and organs, psychic structures and orders. We find processes of an external or internal kind, drives, acts, changes of state. What is there and what happens, we see as a unity. It doesn't just appear to us as such, it is. We would have to distrust any perception if we wanted to doubt that we really are a unity of our body and our soul. It is us, and we cannot help but relate to this unity, everything that becomes individual, what happens to us and through us, as a kind of glue that supports it, or as an effect that emanates from it. This unity does not lie in a single order of relationships like that of a machine. In this, in the machine, the parts are only mechanically next to, behind, or on top of each other. But here, inside of me, I can't help but look at depth to the next, behind and above one another. Here, I find an outside and an inside. That already is obvious in how anatomical internal organs or parts relate to external ones, but then also in the facts of sensation and movement, and also in how the processes of consciousness relate to physical ones, or inner psychic happenings to more superficial ones. It's a relationship that I can only do justice by seeing an inside as being related to an outside, an outside sold to an inside, to a final depth. And something inside goes outside up to a final limit. I do not find this relationship with the machine. All parts are simply next to, behind, or on top of each other. The unity of the living also contains this machine order, but it is not exhausted therein. It is not just made up of parts, but also has the direction of depth. And indeed, the most fleeting observation shows how the living whole takes in from the outside in, nourishing with forces and substances, and builds up from the inside out. It grows. So, oh man, I have to continue because I love this. This unity is built. Again, the next observation shows that it is built according to a plan, not in such a way that all sorts of substances accidentally lay together or external forces and influences intersect, although this also happens. Essentially, it is a matter of an orderly process dominated by a building plan, by an internally present and effective figure. That is a really beautiful way of saying living beings, bugs, plants, animals, people have souls.
Yeah, it's about the soul. The unity of the inner and the outer and your senses and how it all mixes together creates an experience that you're having that is an undeniable one that has to be distinct from mechanical things because you experience right. it as a unity somehow.
Exactly.
Is that what we're trying to do then with this digital electronic world? We're trying to put a soul into it?
Like, we're extending its abilities to... we're extending the thing that becomes unity for you. It's like your Twitter is, you feel that, like in Sensorium article, the first one, the person talks about how Twitter has become their exoskeleton, their avatar, their profile, what they do out there. They now sense that as how other people sense them.
Right.
Then they have a sense of that.
There is no escape.
Yeah. And so the Twitter
understanding media, the extensions of man.
Yeah. It's like you get Chrome extensions and then it does more. So you are adding by participating. And another person in the Sensorium article says they use their Twitter. They used to just think kind of mushy thoughts and operate through the day. But then they started tweeting and then it made them start thinking incomplete thoughts. Now, because they're thinking about how to tweet as they're thinking, how would this be a tweet?
They're thinking in the form of a tweet.
They're thinking in the form of a tweet. So that is now an inner thing Twitter shaped their inner how they think. Right. Like mechanically, they think in complete sentences, whereas before they thought in, you know, those blurry thoughts you can have where you kind of feel stuff, but you don't have to put it all the way to words. But if you think about Twitter all the time, it alters your inner life to where now you think in tweetable thoughts.
Right. And not only in the form of the sentences, but also how they're going to be met. So picturing an audience of potentially, you know, in my case, there are 5,000 people that follow me. So I picture them, but my account's not locked. So I also, if I want to be really thinking in the form of a tweet, what happens more often is subconsciously I'm thinking in the form of a tweet without recognizing that I'm doing that. I am putting in place not only the 5,000 people that are going to see it, but also the fact that it's public, the fact that anyone who hates me can retweet it. Anyone who wants to search that word can find it later, you know. And so recognizing that, you know, to quote McLuhan again, or his friend John Culkin, that we shape our tools and thereafter they shape us.
Yeah.
That these forms inform how we act. It brings me to a sort of another quote from Pope Francis where he says, we have to accept that technological products are not neutral, for they create a framework which ends up conditioning lifestyles and shaping social possibilities. Mm-hmm. He says, decisions which may seem purely instrumental are in reality decisions about the kind of society we want to build. Yeah. That is to say, you know, what form would be good to have, you know, when you can recognize these things.
Which is also the danger of like propaganda, because you can be something can be created and you believe it and you're
it's very dangerous, taking
something for granted.
I mean, it's why Fox News looks like it does and acts like it does, and it forms your opinions and puts you to a side
also why the guy who wrote that sentence I just read swore off, made a vow not to watch television as early as 1990.
Wow.
It hasn't since.
Oh, man.
Most people don't know that.
Well, he missed some good TV, though.
He missed season two of Twin Peaks.
Right.
You know? So it's a give and a take.
But. Think about the way, not just that Fox News shapes the minds of its recipients, but think about, for instance, the algorithms and of media that shape the agents that create the news or our personalities. So Ben Shapiro comes to mind. We understand that the environment shapes his personality. And then we act like, that's his personality.
Audience.
But the algorithm tells him who to be.
The formal cause of any work of art. You know?
Yeah, but when you're, and I felt this, I mean, I feel this as a creator or in the media space, what starts to work for your audience that you think you're just being yourself for starts to shape you and how you see the world and what you do. So what works in an algorithm will start to shape what you think and say as the creator. It starts driving you. And we know many people who have fallen victim to that type of public figure disease is what I call it, where it's not that person anymore. It's the person merged with an algorithm trying to reach followers. And it takes the person over.
Right. And in fact, it's amazing that you mentioned Fox News, because Roger Ailes, the guy who really made that, he set himself apart in the Nixon administration by saying, don't listen to Marshall McLuhan. This is actually true.
Wow.
And he wrote a book called You Are the Message.
Oh, no way.
Saying, getting what you want by being who you are. So that's very different.
It's
from
weird.
Our tools shape us. He's basically saying, ignore the tools, ignore the way that you're disseminating thought and the way that it shapes you while you're doing it. Just do it, yeah. You know, and enjoy the new boundaries of power that you're afforded by winning people over in a sort of Dale Carnegie, you know, con man sort of way.
Man, that's shaped our institution so much, that type of thinking. And we're, you know, that's a big thing about the Center for the Study of Digital Life is they aren't not caught up or ready for what's next. And so I guess that's a lot of what y'all do. So let, just for contrast, let me ask you, why is does Weezer get worse after Pinkerton?
That is, now we're getting to the real philosophical question.
Now we're getting deep.
So that's a really good question. You know, I want to say it, the most obvious thing is that MTV changed too. You know, their ground changed. And after Rivers goes to college, it's a little different, you know.
Yeah.
But they make that first record, Blue with Rick Ocasek, I think. Then the second one, they self-produce and they try to go a little harder by getting the Flaming Lips producer on board. But yeah, then famously, there's a split between Rivers Cuomo and Matt Sharp.
Yeah.
Matt Sharp leaves the band, right? But then, you know, there's this whole giant wealth of Weezer B-sides.
The
I don't
best.
Know if any
yeah.
Weezer,
love
the B-sides okay, are the yeah. best. That's our favorite.
So we all know what's really good then. Okay, good.
I just threw out perfect. The Love of My Dreams, Devotion, all that. Yeah.
A Man After My Own Heart. That is exact. Yo, literally, I have covers of those chiptune covers from like way, way back. Beautiful melodies. So what happened is Rivers Cuomo went to Harvard. And he went to Harvard to study music. And he thought he didn't have the goods. And he wanted to get the goods. And when he tried to get the goods, I don't know what happened, man. I think he started thinking in terms of theory a bit. But this is all, I don't know. It's difficult for me to say. But I think the answer is the audience changed.
And the audience influenced him. Kind of like I was always thought,
he thought
that Pinkerton was such a disappointment that he was like, oh, let me try to go back to that Blue album thing. And so he became the copies of the Blue album. You know, it feels like worse copies of the Blue album every single time. There's some gems on all the records to me a little bit, but just
I agree.
But that Pinkerton, the first time I heard Pinkerton, I could not understand it. I was like, this is what is happening here? This is like a major label band, and it sounds like they're a garage in a way, but I love it. It opened up a whole world to me. I would say that's the first, to me, that's the first emo record I ever heard, honestly. I know that's probably not considered emo in the sense of, you know, what
no,
the band Mineral or something like that. But
there's that line, even Izzy's Flash and Axl Rose.
Right.
And Suzanne. He goes, that original line was even Kurt Cobain and Axl Rose, but he got rid of that.
He got rid of it.
I think out of respect. Yeah. So, you know, there was that whole moment in the late 80s, early 90s, which Weezer really rises out of, which is how does punk how do people who aren't macho fit into the metal world, which is so obviously sick?
Right. You know,
like, yeah, nerds doing tough metal. Yeah, that's right.
That's yeah,
right.
And that's the story of both Nirvana and Weezer.
Yeah.
But Nirvana sort of got into it through a different direction. Man, dude, we should do a whole podcast about this.
Yeah, for sure. There's lots to do, and I don't know if your time's up here, but I thought
no, it's not. It's not. Okay, but if yours is, but
no,
I don't
mine's
know.
Not.
But I'm just like, your question is so good, and I think honestly, I'm too involved in the question.
No, I just wanted to do that a little bit because it's so common for us, and I have so many thoughts about that separately. But I feel, you know, my take on Pinkerton is just that Rivers got burnt by it. Like, it was vulnerable and real and raw in that sense that I just, that just totally wakes me up and makes me want to do that kind of stuff. But he felt like it didn't sell well. And he's like, okay, you want the pop? I'll give you the pop. And it's just cynical in a way. He's like, hey, I'm going to give you Beverly Hills from now on because that's what you really want.
Beverly Hills.
You know, you know, and that's, it's, and so it's, but also I say it in a beautiful way because good for him. I mean, good for him. He's got, it's a thing. The Weezer has a place.
They say that Weezer, what is Weezer without fans that hate them, you know?
But it left open, I think it's actually really profound because it left open space for everybody to interpret what Weezer should have done. You got Ozma, or you got What You Do.
Oh, yeah.
You know, there's bands in our scene, like Me Without You, who often get close to Weezer, and we often try to get there and stuff. And when we say that, we mean extensions of Pinkerton. There's a lineage of bands that carry that, and it just doesn't happen to be Rivers Cuomo. So it has its own, I think that the Pinkerton inspiration to the emo scene and beyond is just super deep. And I hear stuff from it, you know, all the time. The story about it that's funny is that we learned music in about 99, recording on an 8-track, and I learned to record and make
like an ape 8-track?
No, on a digital 8-track, on a zip disc at the time. But I recorded Pinkerton and tried to recreate every sound and part on it with just me and my friends, and I got a different person to sing each track.
Oh, that's so we sick.
And it was the first, that's how I learned to record music and play and figure out guitar sounds and, you know, figure out how to incorporate keyboards, which I've always been obsessed with, keyboards and synths and analog.
Dude, that's
synths
why those B-sides
like
are so so fresh. I just threw out The Love of My Dreams, that sick saw wave.
It's amazing.
That's exactly the story of how Onomatoguchi sort of started. We were doing Weezer covers in my basement on a little digital 4-track, and we just happened to be playing Mega Man when we would break for, you know, for snack time, and then it came back, and I was like, "What if Weezer and Mega Man were in the same room?"
Oh, that's awesome!
That was
it's great. I think people should check it out. And you did the Scott Pilgrim video game soundtrack, and
that's
our last special that we did, when I created like a document for it for the videographers and us to tie everything together, and I had a bunch of Weezer images and Scott Pilgrim images. So this is what we want it to like when we record this special as a playthrough of our album, and you know that's just kind of our world of inspiration anyway. But I wanted to ask you what, because to me it's not very random, the Center for the Study of Digital Life and musical interest and stuff like that. Are you familiar with Howard Gardner? And he talks about multiple intelligences and musical intelligence as one of the types of intelligence.
But I have heard a phrase that the artists are the antenna of the human race.
Well, there's some connection because there's so many people that I know that are good at music that have this abstract type of interdisciplinary intelligence that Rivers goes to Harvard, you know, the stuff you're interested in talking about, but can obsess about a video game and the music theory and how to build chords and stuff like that is the same. Those things are super related. In the way to approach knowledge and to channel abstract things and bring them to reality, kind of a thing. So I've just always felt like there's so many people in music that I know and have encountered that are like genius like people, and they don't, and it's so underutilized. You know, they should be more cross domain kind of a thing, because it's the type of intelligence I think musicians have is can be really quite useful.
Well, yeah, this is the notion of, you know, the old Renaissance man.
Yeah, exactly. Right? Exactly.
It's also that I think the musicians, but like take rock music, for example, you have to push back to get into rock music. Like your parents don't want you to do that. And, you know, I'm going to learn an instrument and go play this show with three people there. And it matters. Like you have to do all that and create this world and this reality where it is important. It is real. And to do that, I think it really does hone your skills. And you do have to have a level of intelligence to pull that off. I mean, when you and I were running sound and playing shows at, for what it's worth, Matt, in Rock Hill, South Carolina with three people there, we kept going. And like you have to have some kind of almost spiritual ideal
and
intelligence of seeing what could be. You know what I mean? People don't see what could be. They just
see
some barbing.
You have to
be
very open. You have to be intelligent. You have to be able to put stuff together mechanically.
Right.
You have to have the interest in that. And you have to believe in something outside that is not here. And that's what the institutions and everybody doesn't get is you're just trying to control all the shit that's here. That's not, right. We got to go somewhere. I mean, we got to find things and bring them to reality and synthesize them and make them make the, we have to make stuff.
Yeah.
We have to make the
like
world.
That definition of the word secular, meaning this place, this time, you know, nothing outside of right here, right now. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
There's an aspect that I want to highlight, because I actually do have to go at a certain point, but a catchy phrase that really made me think when I first met Mark is he said to me, digital retrieves the medieval. And I was like, what does that mean? You know? But it's becoming clearer to me what that means. You know, we talked about just the title of McLuhan's book, you know, Understanding Media, Extensions of Man. He said later when he was revising Understanding Media, he found out that he wanted to say multiple things that every artifact, every human artifact does. He says, not only do they extend, but they also push things out or they obsolesce other things. They also retrieve things that have been previously obsolesced, and they also flip their characteristics when pushed to a limit. So these four questions, you know, what does it extend? What does it obsolesce? What does it retrieve? And what does it flip into?
Damn.
These are questions that McLuhan put in his book, Laws of Media, which again is sort of Understanding Media 2.0. Those four questions are super medieval. We're talking about synthesis just now, where he was writing someone in the 70s when he had just come up with this, saying, this all sounds a bit Hegelian, I know, you know, that there's, you know, a sort of concretion, negation, that whole thing, abstraction, concretion, whatever. But in terms of theses, we're talking thesis, antithesis, synthesis, but he's saying, Hegel doesn't have the retrieval bit, as far as I know. That is, studying patterns of change, patterns of evolution, instead of just assuming linear development to that change in shape, McLuhan says it's, you know, perfectly natural to assume that that shapes or forms, after they're pushed out of existence or pushed out of our areas of attention, can be brought back into areas of attention. And they'll seem new, but they've really been there sort of the whole time. What I like about that retrieval thing is that it brings time into the question and says, in order for something to be retrieved, it had to have been pushed out in the first place. So, McLuhan called these things tetrads, these four questions that you can ask about any human artifact from, you know, writing to a spoon to a trend or a meme on TikTok or whatever. But he used it on some pretty big ones like television and computer. So he has in the flip quadrant for television, inner trip. A sort of, you know, fantasizing endlessly, you know, to quote my own band, Endless Fantasy. But he has in computer, it says, what does it enhance? Speeds of calculation and retrieval. Retrieval being one of the four parts of the tetrad. What does it obsolesce? You know, the bookkeeper, the archivist, that whole thing. What does it flip into when pushed to its limits? Anarchy via the overlay of bureaucracy, you know, sort of when it looks like everything's in order, you sort of, no one's in charge because no one's touching the thing. And that I guess is the world of AGI, you know, oh, we'll let the computer do it for us.
Right. Uh-huh. But that becomes anarchy because it is so orderly that it flips to anarchy
Yeah, that the bureaucracy turns into no one's responsible for it.
Right.
So no one in charge is an anarchy, no leader. But then in the retrieval question, you know, what does it retrieve? The answer is perfect memory, total and exact, which is kind of scary, you know, but also presents new options.
It's really scary. The total memory being exact, like you said earlier about this conversation, will be web crawled by computers and agents and people, regardless if we wanted to forget it. I like to remember it as a paraphrase, as you said. You know, right. but it's going to be remembered as exactly how stupid I actually am and what I exactly right. said. And it won't. And one time I got into an experiment where I recorded my audio of me walking around on a belt pack I did it for 2 months. I recorded every single thing that happened to me. I just was recording all the time.
Whoa.
For an experiment. And I was horrified at the way it felt to, I thought I was going to be able to settle all these arguments and go back and look at all this stuff. And I was very surprised when you go back to listen to things, it's not what I remembered, and it didn't solve shit. You know, I was like, oh my gosh, how crazy is it? Like, the reality I live in is one where I summarize, paraphrase, re-say that argument, this is what, rename that conflict, and then if you go back and look at the bare thing with perfect memory, it's like, oh, that's totally different than what I perceived was going on or would ever have remembered, you know?
Well, what we're talking about here is sort of the difference between logic and analogy, where logic is a sort of three-part unfolding process, but between a premise and a conclusion. But then if you ask whence, where the fuck did that premise come from, you enter the world of analogy, which is four parts. You know, A is to B as C is to D. And this is something I discovered when I was looking up the etymologies of words, which I love doing. I love, you know, being like, asking that whence, where the fuck did that come from, to words or trends or whatever. Like when people say swag and based, I'm like, okay, you like Lil B. And they're like, who's Lil B? Well, that's the guy that made that popular, you know. Anyway, so analogos is Greek roots. And if you were to bring them into English in the way that they've conventionally been done, ana and logos, you'd get rewording. So that's kind of strange. And in fact, you might even get reverbing, you know, this invisible environment of reverb or rewording things.
Reverbing. Oh, yeah. Interesting.
Well, yeah. Everybody needs a little reverb.
But I wanted to bring something up too about when you mentioned this whole driving you crazy thing. McLuhan had an interview with John Lennon in 1969 and Yoko Ono too. And he said, have you heard that report that it's possible to drive a man mad by putting his own heartbeat on a PA system and just making him listen to his own heartbeat? And John Lennon replied, well, we just made a record of that. He'll all be going mad now. Well, that's what made us mad then, the record we gave to your boy. And so he says, it's amazing, that heartbeat. And he says, we made that record. We recorded both of our heartbeats. And he said, what did he say? On record, you can't get things very loud on wax, but we did it as loud as we could, and the whole side of the album is heartbeat, and we just shout on top of it. And McLuhan says, but that's putting it in another medium. You don't have to listen to your own heartbeat when you put it in another medium. He said, I'm reading this right now.
That's all right.
Yeah, so he goes, wow, this is just a fascinating conversation. The whole thing is on YouTube if anyone wants to eventually check that out. But Ono says that they were maybe helped by being together there with their heartbeats. Who knows?
Yeah, I can imagine that, listening to your own heartbeat as it's beating probably would drive you insane.
And anyway, thinking you're going to put that on a record and you're John Lennon and Yoko. I mean, they must have just been just so far out there. It's just ridiculous.
Yeah,
I mean,
before the time. Well, Peter, thank you so much for joining us today, man. This has been great. I'm going to leave right now and drive 13 hours to Hilton Head. So
Toby's going on vacation.
I'm going on vacation.
13 hours?
Yeah,
what?
I live in Champaign, Illinois, so I got a long drive. I won't drive the whole way.
Hey, Champaign, Illinois, yeah. Champaign Urbano. We got Polyvinyl Records out there.
Oh, yeah.
They just put out Anna Monoguchi's latest album, USA.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so make sure to stop by Papa Del's for some pizza.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I live right by there. There's a nice. How did you get with that label? I think
Polyvinyl. Yeah. We met them in, I want to say, like 2018 or something. Yeah. They were working with, obviously, we've been fans of Polyvinyl bands for forever, like with the whole emo world, you know. But they were working with our buddies, Caro Caro Bonito from England. And we met them at a festival and got along really well. My dad was making jokes with the like label head and stuff. They were having a good time. And yeah, we took a meeting in New York City and we were like, yeah, we have this record called USA that's about this kind of like social tension that we felt sort of growing. And instead of like, basically this is our move away from Endless Fantasy and towards, you know, paying attention to our own lives and how they've been shaped. And so they were fascinated by that thought. And they were like, yeah, we want to put that record out.
That's
so
right. That's very cool.
Yeah.
All right, Peter. Well, we really appreciate your time, man. Hopefully we'd love to have you back sometime. Talk more.
Dude, yeah, we got to do that Weezer podcast.
Yeah, yeah.
Toby and Matt, you guys are awesome.
For sure.
I'm so glad this got to go down.
Yeah.
So
sweet. Yeah. Enjoy the rest of your day, dude.
Take care, buddies. Bye-bye.
All right, Matt, I really do have to go.
Okay. That was plenty long.
Reba just arrived at my house from, you know, she drove 2.5 hours. She's watching our dogs and hanging out here and for a week by herself at our house.
So well, you can go, but first you had to reflect on that interview. How'd you find that?
A lot of it was over my head, and it was fascinating and interesting. We went all over the place. What about yourself?
Well, I mean, it was hard to get bearings from such abstract topics, I felt like. But I love that. I understand that there's many open threads on that and broad things and all over time and space. But that's kind of just a tour of the mind of somebody who, I mean, that you could, you know what I mean? His mind's just all over the place. So I think that.
He just knows something about everything. He's just moving quickly and tapping into information, memories, and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's cool. A different wiring of a brain, but it's all very self-directed, interest-driven to a bunch of
curious,
fascinating, you know, interesting things. So I like to try to keep up and jump around with people like that, but I enjoyed it. But thank you for doing it and finding Peter, because I think you found that thing or tracked him down or whatever, but I just thought it was neat, somebody who thinks so abstractly and does the same type of music and all that kind of stuff.
All right, see y'all.
See y'all.